Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Betsy Fentress.
And I'm Mary Fiorito.
And we're so happy to discuss today a historic moment this week at the Canterbury Cathedral when a Catholic Mass was celebrated at the Anglican Cathedral. And we have the former chaplain to the Queen of England, Gavin Ashenden, who was there joining us this morning to tell us all about it. Welcome back to the show, Gavin.
Thank you. Very glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me on again.
I understand this is an annual tradition to mark the life of St. Thomas Becket. Can you tell us about this important Mass and why this year was a little different?
Well, I'd love to. I've just been asked by the organizers to give a brief synopsis of 20 lines. And if I can use that, because it's succinct, and then we can use it as a platform for further conversation. I was there because I was asked to give a lecture beforehand. But essentially, the Mass celebrated by the Papal Nuncio at Canterbury Cathedral to celebrate the anniversary of the moving of the relics of St. Thomas to his shrine in about 1250 was memorable and significant for several important reasons. The whole event was a celebration of the return of the Catholic faith to the first and most important cathedral that Catholics built in Britain, the ejection of Catholics from their cathedrals and churches, and their sequestration by the state in the 1530s is a wound that continues to cause pain amongst English Catholics. So the arrival of the Papal Nuncio, whose role it is to represent the Pope himself, and who is the first nuncio to celebrate Mass since the early 1500s, felt like the beginning of the healing of that wound. The opportunity to celebrate the courage and integrity of St. Thomas Becket, who gave his life for the Catholic faith in opposition to the brutality and overreach of the English state, was a source of joy and pride to all the Catholics who attended the Mass. And the honouring of Our Lady, Mary, so precious to Jesus in the Gospels and to Catholics throughout history, through the singing of the Salve Regina at the end of the Mass, was simply electrifying. The sight of authentic Catholics, bishops and priests at the high altar, in front of the throne of St. Augustine, the earliest Catholic bishop who founded the cathedral in 597, was as inspiring as it was healing and joyful. For all Catholics who remember that it was their forebears who evangelized Europe, built the cathedrals, founded the Catholic faith in this country 1,500 years ago, the return of Catholics to celebrate Mass at Canterbury Cathedral, their cathedral, however temporary, offered a moment of profound inspiration and hope for the future.
It's beautiful. That brings tears to my eyes almost listening to that. It's what a momentous occasion. And Gavin, can you tell us a little bit about who St. Thomas Becket was? Because I think most Americans would probably be more familiar with someone like St. Thomas More, but you don't hear as much, at least here, about St. Thomas Becket. Who was he, and in what way was he martyred?
Let me just start by telling you a little bit, as your vice president has done, about the situation in England today. And then you'll see one of the reasons why it's resonance for us. So the English state, once again, is moving against Christians and Catholics. It's introducing the thought of thought crime. It's getting the police to arrest Catholics who stand within a quarter of a mile of an abortion centre because new buffer zones have been there. And so the police will approach somebody and say, are you a Catholic? Are you praying? And if the answer is yes to both, they arrest them. So the struggle between the Catholic faith and the English state has re-emerged today in a way that's a reminder of some of the things that happened in the past. St. Thomas More faced the wrath of King Henry VIII, who wanted to separate the church from Rome and start his own branch Protestant church and succeeded in it. Interestingly enough, 300 years before, in 1170, King Henry II did exactly the same thing. I mean, it's almost identical. Thomas More, Thomas a Becket, both of them confronted a king who wanted to separate the church from Rome, from the Pope, and start, if you like, their own branch church run by the state. In both cases, the state killed them for doing it. But the effect, of course, has been exactly the opposite, because as the church fathers said, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. And they're remembered for calling out the state and saying, actually, to the rulers, you have no rights over the way in which we practice the faith here. And if you insist on exercising political rights, we're willing to give our lives to defend them. And one of the reasons why we celebrate Thomas Becket and Thomas More is because they put those principles into practice.
I was first introduced to Thomas Becket by T.S. Eliot's play, Murder in the Cathedral. I think that's probably how Americans, at least in academia, were introduced to him. So you were there, correct, at this historic event?
Yes.
And I've read that it was the largest gathering of Catholics in that space since before it was became Anglican. Paint the picture for us. I heard that I've seen video, the choir, the vestments. It was very high church, right?
Well, the context is that I grew up there. So the cathedral was placed in a precinct, a kind of compound with walls around it, begun in 597. And before he built the cathedral, St. Augustine of Canterbury started a school. It was a school for trainee monks. And they took children and they taught them to read and to write with the prospect of them becoming monks and priests. And it is, in fact, the oldest school in the world. And it's continued from 597 to today without an interruption, apart from the name when the state took it over. And I was lucky enough to be sent to that school from the age of 12 to 18. So I grew up around the cathedral. I was confirmed as an Anglican in the cathedral. When I went back in yesterday, I found myself sitting 10 feet away from where I knelt before the Archbishop of Canterbury as a 15-year-old to be confirmed. Now, the thing is, there's a lot of high church in Anglicanism, particularly in cathedrals. But I don't know how to say this without being rude. The thing is, it's never quite Catholic. There's always a sense that it's hard to know whether this is a spiritual or a theological perception or metaphysical, but it just isn't the real thing. And one of the reasons I know that was because for the first time I saw the real thing in Canterbury Cathedral, and it was just incredible. All of us who were there, we were thrilled. They were real bishops, real priests, the real mass, not a confected placebo. Because Anglicans don't have any power to make the Mass. They do something else. It's very sweet. It's a remembrance of Maundy Thursday, but it isn't the Mass. The miracle of transubstantiation doesn't happen. To see the miracle taking place on the high altar at the hands of the Pope's personal representative, surrounded by other bishops, surrounded by 30 or 40 priests, surrounded by a choir full of exultant Catholics, was just the most thrilling moment. You know, when we sang the Salve Regina at the end, I looked round, as I always do, having become a Catholic, for a statue of Our Lady so I can sing it to her. The statue represents her. And as I looked round, I realised the wretched Protestants had stripped her out of everywhere. She wasn't there. There wasn't a single memory of her anywhere. There might have been in the bottom of a stained glass window somewhere I couldn't access. But this gap between the way in which they'd stripped the real faith out of the buildings we made, because every cathedral is a reliquary for Jesus. Every cathedral is a reminder of the crucifixion by the cruciform shape. And at the heart of it is a tabernacle with the living Jesus there. It's a living event whilst it's Catholic. But if you stop it being Catholic, well, it becomes a building. And one of the things that people have said during my lifetime is that there's kind of the slight sense of the presence of God that those stones have soaked up through the prayers and the longing of people. And one of the things we might talk about is the miracles around Thomas Becket's shrine. That sense of the presence of God has been evaporating. Even in my lifetime, there's a kind of the emptiness of the place has grown. And then suddenly, yesterday, I can't tell you how it happened. The place was thick with the presence of God as the Catholic Mass was celebrated. And I can't prove this, but everyone around me said it's the same thing. The place is suddenly inhabited by the glory of God again, and it's kind of overwhelming. And this is not a tribal thing. It's not a party thing. It's not an aesthetic thing. It's not for, you know, spiritual superstars. It just, for anyone who knows Jesus in the Mass, it just kind of bangs you on the chest and you take a step backwards thinking, He's back. We're here again. This is amazing. And Protestants wouldn't understand this, but any Catholic would know immediately that the difference between a cathedral without Jesus in the sacrament there and one with him there is like the sense of a beating heart in a body.
Gavin, I had the opportunity to go to a funeral recently for a neighbor who was Episcopalian, and I was quite surprised when I entered the church to see a little side altar to Our Lady of Walsingham. Is that not a veneration that would be obviously not? You said there was no image of Our Lady. Is that not universal within the Anglican Church, devotion to her?
No, absolutely not. So the Anglican Church was completely and wholly Protestant until about the 1850s. And then I think I'd best describe it by saying that a group of very well motivated men suffered from a degree of what I would call a sacramental nostalgia. I think we are meant for the Mass. The Mass had been here since 597 for 1,000 years. And I think there's a kind of almost kind of like a subconscious memory in our corporate soul. And so a group of Anglicans said, is there any way in which we can reconnect with our Catholic faith? And they tried. The problem is that Anglicanism is built upon an absolutely articulated repudiation of the Mass. They have 39 articles. They describe the Mass as a blasphemous fable. It's not allowed, it's forbidden. And so although many Anglicans rebel against their articles, which is an act of ecclesial disobedience and not an entirely honourable thing to do. Frankly, if they want the Mass, they want Jesus, they want Our Lady, they just need to become Catholics. But in a nostalgic way, there was a reaching out for her. And so many Anglicans who are nostalgic for the real faith have tried to incorporate it into Anglicanism. The problem is it hasn't grown, it's shrunk, it doesn't work, it's very well intentioned. But the real problem is that it's actually quite deceptive, because what it suggests to Anglicans is they can have access to the Eucharist, they can have access to Our Lady, and they can stay Episcopalians. But you see, they can't. And so in that sense, we have to call that out as a piece of, well, I think it's called cosplay in some places. And the reason that the converts like me find this unconvincing is because the Pope has said the orders are not valid, nothing happens in the Anglican Eucharist. It's a very nice celebration of Maundy Thursday, but they don't get Jesus in the Mass. And therefore, every Anglican Eucharist takes place and fills a space where the authentic Catholic Mass ought to be. There's no honor in in depriving people of Jesus in the Mass and giving them a placebo, however well-intentioned it is. And so I know this isn't polite, and people think, well, maybe you could be a bit more ecumenical and generous. But the point is, if someone needs the medicine of immortality, which is what the sacrament has been called by the fathers, and you give them instead a placebo instead of an antibiotic when they're ill, there's nothing kind in that. And so some of us find the Episcopalian imitation of the Catholic faith moving, but entirely unconvincing and unhelpful.
Following up with Mary's question about the Blessed Mother in England, why was it originally called Mary's Dowry?
There was a great devotion to Our Lady in the Middle Ages. Some people use the word medieval as an insult. I mean, particularly they call Islam medieval. This is a terrible mistake. I don't think there has ever been a higher culture amongst human beings than Europe in the High Middle Ages, when Catholic culture flourished. The best buildings, the best music, the invention of hospitals and hospices and universities and education, all this was part of the flowering of high medieval Catholic culture, including a very profound love of Our Lady. She appeared at Walsingham. She appeared at St. Bartholomew's in London. She appeared in the 700s to a swineherd in a very beautiful part of the country called the Vale of Evesham. There was a great love of her. And so to when Catholics were thrown out of the country, and imprisoned and disemboweled, in an order in it's all very well for the state church to now say, well, we'd quite like to imitate the Mass. But the Church of England was founded on the persecution and torture of Catholic priests who held out with the most enormous heroic bravery, because it was in the DNA of the Protestant state to deprive people of the Mass. And it's a bit cheeky at one level to have spent hundreds of years persecuting Catholics, keeping the Mass out, calling Catholics foreigners and traitors to the country. And then when the politics change a bit, saying, well, yes, okay, we'll pretend to be Catholics now. It's not convincing. But there was a deep deep love of Our Lady, and the sense is that if we can only honor Our Lady, then we may, with God's help, reclaim the country and the hearts of its people for the Catholic Church. So she again can be honored as the saints and the angels honor her in heaven, which is what we're called to do.
You know, I was quite touched to see Prince William attending the funeral of Pope Francis. And, you know, I thought it was a very respectful gesture. Do you find the attitudes, some of the anti-Catholicism that is so steeped in the English history, do you find some of those things beginning to soften now?
Not at all. Prince William was there because it's his duty to be polite. The English monarchy is very polite, and that's nice. It's nice to be nice. It's nice to be polite. Courtesy is very valuable. But William doesn't go to church. He's not interested in God. He's not interested in Christianity or Jesus. He's not even interested in the Protestant Church of England. So there's going to be a crisis when his father dies. And William, having been perfectly free with journalists to say, well, frankly, I don't really care. I don't think about God. I don't go to church. He's going to have a shock when he steps up and is invited to swear an oath that he'll be defender of the faith, because the people will say, wait a moment, you spent the whole of your life saying you don't care. How is it you could move from that to swear an oath to defend the Protestant faith? That must be hypocritical, surely. So the danger is that if you like, the monarchy are doing themselves out of a job by not caring enough about even Protestant Christianity. The problem with Catholic Christianity is it's uncompromising. It's uncompromising about the sanctity of life. It's Catholics who are protesting against abortions. It's Catholics who are protesting against euthanasia. It's Catholics who are willing to defend the sanctity of life. Protestants have, I'm not being rude to Protestants, I was one for almost all of my life. But the problem is that it doesn't have a role anymore, because it was founded with the intention of keeping Catholicism at bay, and there's no need for that now. It doesn't even attempt to do it. It just misrepresents it and misunderstands it. But that's not a reason to be an ecclesial community. So it's rather lost its way. It doesn't accept the authority of the scriptures as it's supposed to. And frankly, one of the reasons why so many of us are becoming Catholics is because Protestantism can't be relied on, either ethically or in the way in which it reads the Bible. But the Catholic faith is unchanging and unchanged. And as a crisis, there's a very good book by an American called John Davidson, called Pagan America. And one of the things John has done is to show how paganism in both Europe and America is the main competitor to the faith, and how people are slipping into paganism. And the reason this matters is that paganism hates Christianity. One of the reasons why woke culture and progressive culture attack, the first place of attack is Christians, and very often Catholics. And so we're involved in a struggle to save civilization, which is another reason why I feel quite passionate about all this and uncompromising, because lives are at stake. A civilization is at stake. The lives of millions of babies are at stake. The lives of the elderly is at stake. The salvation of people's souls are at stake. And I've become convinced, like so many people, that, and this is not partisanship, it's discovery, that only the Catholic Church stands a chance of actually fulfilling the challenge that we're presented with.
Evan, we have just a little bit of time left, and I wanted to circle back to you saying about the miracles attributed to St. Thomas a
Yes.
Becket, which are illustrated in the stained glass windows of the cathedral. Can you maybe just give us one quick miracle that's illustrated?
Let me tell you my favorite one. Just outside Canterbury, there's a village called Fordwich, 3 miles down the road. I know it because I used to get on my bicycle as a 15-year-old and cycle there to row. I was taught to row in the school's rowing team. That's where Fordwich is. Well, there was a man called Hugh of Fordwich in about the year 1200, and he was a psychotic madman. He was violent and psychopathic and dangerous, and so the villagers bound him by his hands with rope and wooden staves to control him from killing people. And they decided they'd bring him to the shrine of St. Thomas, 3 miles away. So they brought him in, amongst the monks, and they left him there, bound hand and foot, in front of the coffin and bones of St. Thomas. And in the morning when they came, he was completely restored to his right mind. So they took off the rope and the wooden staves, and they walked him home where he was welcomed by his family. And they kept the rope and the staves there, as they kept the crutches there of all the people who were healed of lameness. And he's now in a window to celebrate it. And there were a number of people who were healed of dreadful mental distresses by praying in front of the shrine. The shrine became one of the most powerful shrines in the whole of Europe. It was competed with Santiago de Compostela. People came from all over the world, literally, to pray there. And there were two, the monks were set aside to test the miracles, because they didn't want fakes and forgeries any more than anybody else did. And they were scientific, and they were assiduous about the way they tested the claims of people who said they were healed. They wrote them down, and they wrote down why they wrote them down, and the records are all there. And they just happened time after time after time after time. And it was the most wonderful place of healing and celebration, which is why Chaucer wrote his book, The Canterbury Tales, because it was the place to go if you were troubled.
That is a great place for us to end. Gavin Ashenden, thank you so much for joining us. And to learn more about what we do, visit thecatholicassociation.org for everything in radio, TV, print, Substack, and online. Thank you, Gavin.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, where I am joined by Monsignor Roger Landry, our resident TCA chaplain and head of the U.S. Pontifical Mission Society. He joins us from Krakow today. And we're going to be talking about couples who were both beatified together. Father, tell us, we have some important feasts coming up.
Well, so this week we are bookended by two married couples that have been raised to the altars. On Monday, the first mass that I had here in Krakow, we were able to remember Joseph and Veronica Ulma, who were beatified 2 years ago by Pope Francis. They are tremendous heroes from World War II. They, in a place called Markarva here in Poland, used to clandestinely hide Jews who were being hunted down by the Nazis. And so as a result of that, Joseph and Veronica were arrested, and they and their seven children, their six children who had been born, and the seventh child who was within Mrs. Ulma, about to be born, were all executed. And so that seventh baby was actually delivered as the mom was dying, and likewise executed. And so this is a couple that has caught the imagination of the entire Catholic world, especially pro-lifers, because this is the first time we've had somebody canonized who was basically in the womb when martyred, even though, because of the situation with the murder of the mother, was delivered. And so that's the way we began our week here, remembering the Ulma family on July 7th. For me, that was pretty special too, because my identical twin brother, Scott, and his wife, Ximena, on that very day, were celebrating their 25th wedding anniversary, which was the second wedding I had. And so to be able to be here and pray for them and offer the mass for them through the intercession of the Ulmas was a pretty special thing for me. And so that's the way the week begins. And then at the end, on Saturday, on the 12th of July, we have the feast of the two parents of St. Thérèse Lisieux. So St. Louis Eazeli, or Zelie Martin. They had nine kids altogether. Five of them survived into adulthood. All five of those who survived ended up becoming saints. Became religious sisters seeking a holy life. And the youngest of all of them is the famous little flower, St. Thérèse of the Child Jesus in the Holy Face. And so they show us that marriage is meant to produce saints. So the Ulmas clearly did, and the parents of St. Thérèse did. Many of the other sisters of St. Thérèse who entered the convent likewise lived holy lives. They're not as famous as their littlest sister, the ninth of nine, but they are talked about in her own writings and how much they inspired her to take holiness seriously by the holy choices they themselves were making. So it's an opportunity for everybody in the church, especially the listeners to Conversations with Consequences, to remember that marriage is a sacrament, is meant to sanctify the couples, that the twofold purpose of marriage is the sanctification of the husband and the wife, and the procreation and the raising of children likewise to be able to live forever with the parents in heaven. And the only way that that happens is when they're raised to be holy. And so in the middle of the year, each year now, we have a chance to remember these beatified and canonized couples, respectively, that are anchors in the clouds for every family.
And the Martins are pretty particularly interesting because they gave every one of their daughters up to religious life. And, knowing that their family, quote, ended, but of course it didn't, because they're all our sisters in Christ and in sainthood. And tell us a little bit more about one of them was a watchmaker,
Yeah,
and
that
one
was.
was made lace, but he gave up his watchmaking, I think, to run her more successful lace business. Is that correct,
That's
Father?
exactly right. So he, with great magnanimity and also humility, recognized that she was doing so well in Alençon, which was like the lace making capital of France, that it was going to be much better for the family for her to be the one running this winning business. Even though he was an excellent watchmaker, it was much more profitable for their family to do that. They've got such a great story. I mean, he was an Augustinian monk for a little while. She wanted to become a daughter of charity. She was too sick to enter. He discerned out. And then one day they're crossing on a bridge, and Zélie heard within, "This is the man you're going to marry." They pass each other on the bridge. She turns to look at him. He turns back. 3 months later, they were married. And then they had made this Josephite vow at the beginning that they would live out their marriage like Joseph and Mary chastely. But 10
Yes.
months, thanks be to God, they both had good spiritual directors. And their spiritual director said, "This is not God's will for you. He brought you to be married. He wants you to raise up a family for him." And boy, did they raise a family for him.
Boy, did they. Well, thank you so much for joining us. These are both great inspirational couples to take with us. And then our next big one will be, well, the Feast of Saint Joachim and Anne in August. So we've got a lot of people to pray to intercede for holy families and holy couples. Thank you so much, Monsignor Landry.
God
And
bless. Pray for your family, Betsy.
thank you.
Welcome to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire.
And I'm Betsy Fentress.
And we are thrilled to have the one and only Professor Robert George with us today. He is an outspoken thought leader on so many issues plaguing our society, including countering Pride Month with Fidelity Month, always driving home the importance of religious freedom. And now with your new book, Professor George, you're taking on so much more. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ashley. It's a pleasure to be on with you and with my old friend Betsy.
So you have a new book out. I've lost track of how many books you've written, but this book is entitled Seeking Truth and Speaking Truth, Law and Morality in Our Cultural Moment. And it's a collection of essays examining a wide-ranging analysis of topics such as human dignity, common good, natural law, personhood, civic virtue, free market morality, and free speech in universities. And in the preface, you talk about our current moment, and you call it the age of feeling. And that certainly seems accurate. Can you tell us what you meant by that and why you felt like this book, this collection of essays was needed for this moment?
Well, thank you. I'd be happy to talk about that. The historians are fond of breaking up the epochs into the age of this and the age of that. You may remember from history class or just things that you've read on your own that historians sometimes will refer to the medieval period as the age of faith. Now, why do they do that? Well, it's because for the medievals, whether they were Islamic or Jewish or Christian, the touchstone of truth, of goodness, of rightness, of justice, was conformity with the teachings of religion. Now, that's not to say that the medieval people, and especially the great medieval thinkers from all three of the great monotheistic traditions, deprecated reason. They did not. They were great believers in the power of reason. They were great thinkers. They held reason in high esteem. But they put the emphasis on, they gave the priority to faith when it came to thinking about what's true and false, good and bad, right and wrong, just and unjust. Well, these same historians tell us that the Enlightenment era was the age of reason. What did they mean by that? Well, the touchstone for so many Enlightenment figures of goodness, of truth, of rightness, of justice, was conformity with the findings of rational inquiry, especially, of course, in the sciences. We get the emergence of modern science in the Enlightenment period. Now, here again, we have to be careful not to exaggerate. Certainly, Enlightenment figures placed a high priority on reason, but by no means were all of them religious skeptics or unbelievers. Many were religious people themselves who saw, as did the medievals, a kind of harmony between faith and reason. Not all. There were some who were really hardcore secularists, especially among the French Enlightenment figures. But more broadly, there were plenty of people in the Enlightenment who, while giving priority to reason, also thought that there was an important place for faith. Well, if the medieval period is the age of faith, and if the Enlightenment era is the age of reason, I ask myself, in what era do we live? What do people these days, especially younger people, but not exclusively, especially younger people, treat as the touchstone of truth and of goodness and of rightness and of justice? Well, it's not faith, and it's not reason, and it's not, as I think it should be, faith and reason considered as working in a harmony, as the two wings on which the human spirit ascends to contemplation of the truth, in the words of the late Pope John Paul II. No, for so many people today, the touchstone of truth is not faith. It's not reason. It's not faith and reason. It's feeling. They judge something to be true or false, good or bad, right or wrong, depending on how they feel about it or how it makes them feel or how believing it makes them feel. And we've even reached the point at which for so many people today, whether you are male or female, a boy or a girl, a man or a woman, depends not on objective, scientific, biological fact, but rather on how you feel. If you feel you're a woman, you're a woman. If you feel you're a man, even if you're biologically a woman and vice versa. Now, I think this is catastrophic, and it's for this reason. Feeling is an extremely unreliable guide to what is true and false, good and bad, right and wrong. Our feelings are subjective. We cannot figure out what's true or false, good or bad, right or wrong, simply by consulting our viscera. We need to think. We need to draw on the resources that are available to us in the great traditions of faith and by rational inquiry, deliberation, and judgment. We're fallible creatures. We can go wrong even when doing our best to live by faith and reason. But those are much more reliable guides than subjective feeling. And to make matters worse, and this is the last point I'll make in response to your question, Ashley, make matters worse. If we treat feeling as the touchstone or criterion of truth, then our feelings, because subjective, are resistant to critique, to challenge, to criticism. If I feel this way, that's just the way it is. There's nothing that anybody can say, no argument anyone can give, no appeal anyone can make to criticize me. And if I identify my very feelings with truth, then I will come to perceive any criticism or challenge anyone makes to my fundamental beliefs as a personal assault on me. And that's the fast track to dogmatism, to ideology, and to a kind of authoritarianism. Because if all I've got to go on when it comes to truth are my feelings, and you don't go along with my feelings, you see things differently, then my goal can't be to talk you out of it, because reason doesn't have that power. It's going to have to be to defeat you, destroy you, knock you down. And so is it any surprise that people, especially younger people, who have adopted feeling as the criterion of truth, have become the partisans, the practitioners of cancel culture? They become the Twitter mobs. They try to shut people down, deny them free speech, ruin their careers, ruin their lives, instead of engaging in civil discourse. So that's why I wrote the book, as a pushback, as a critique of the age of feeling and the dominant ideologies, such as identitarianism, the dominant ideologies of our time.
So
Professor George, the first part of your book is called Ethical and Metaphysical Questions, The Human Person. So can you take this idea of feelings and play out for us what happens in that chapter, The Nature and Basis of Human Dignity, vis-a-vis euthanasia? Because there's that bill in New York, it's sitting on the governor's desk. How do you counter it with reason that people can understand in, you know, the 21st century?
Sure, Betsy. So it seems to me that the most fundamental principle of all sound morality, I sometimes call it the principle, the basic principle of all sound morality, is the principle of the profound, inherent, and equal dignity of each and every member of the human family. What that means is that there are no natural inferiors or superiors, that our dignity is not something we earn by achieving a certain status or level of education or level of physical or cognitive functioning. We have our dignity because it's inherent. We have our dignity just in virtue of the kind of creatures we are, that is, creatures with a human nature, a rational nature, human beings. The Bible articulates this principle in religious terms in the very first chapter of its very first book, in the book of Genesis, chapter 1, where we're told that man, unlike the brute animals and unlike anything else in creation, man, though made from the mere dust of the earth, is nevertheless fashioned in the very image and likeness of the divine creator and ruler of all that is. There's the foundation, there's the basis of this principle of the profound, inherent, and equal dignity of each and every member of the human family. Now, I believe that we can, in principle at least, arrive at a grasp of that truth even without a specific religious revelation. But I'm glad that God has given us that revelation. Those of us who are Jews and Christians and who honor the Bible believe that God has given us a kind of direct statement of that in the very first chapter of the very first book of the Bible. And what that means is no one can treat himself legitimately or treat other people as mere means to other ends. Human beings are not means, they're ends in themselves. Society, culture, the economy, the educational system are not things people exist for the sake of. They exist for the sake of people. And that gives our lives a certain sanctity, to use a religious term, or to use a neutral term, inviolability. And that means that no one should be subjected to being killed as the direct object of someone's choice in the effort to get ahead or get something that they want. No one can be legitimately enslaved. It took human beings a long time to figure out what was wrong with slavery, and what's wrong with it turns out to be relatively simple. It turns something that is an end in itself, that is, say, a human being, for which other things and other institutions exist, into a mere means for the benefit of other people. And we can't even legitimately, morally sell ourselves into slavery. We don't have the right to do that any more than we have the legitimate moral right to kill ourselves. And that's not because the state owns us. It's because we're the kind of thing that can't be owned. That's why slavery's wrong. We can't be owned. We human beings can't legitimately be owned by other private parties. We can't legitimately be owned by the state. We're not, it's not even correct to say we own ourselves. Rather, what is correct to say is we are the kind of thing that cannot be owned. We're not property. We're not objects. We are subjects, subjects of justice, of human rights, of human dignity. Now, when it comes to these life and death issues, the implications of that principle, the profound, inherent, and equal dignity of each and every member of the human family, are very clear. No killing of babies, born or unborn. No matter how difficult the situation is, if you have a newborn child who's afflicted with a terrible disease, that does not justify what it justified in the eyes of pagan society in antiquity. Infanticide, exposing the children on the hillsides, as the Romans and so many other ancient peoples did. The ancient peoples thought that the Jewish people were odd because they did not expose their children, even their children who were severely disabled at birth. But that's because they had hold of the revelation of the principle of the profound inherent and equal dignity. Same at the other end of life, Betsy. This is why we can't do away with our old people or invite them to commit suicide or to facilitate the committing of suicide, which inevitably brings people under pressure to do that. Let's not kid ourselves. I mean, who ends up committing suicide for the most part in these regimes of assisted suicide? It's not the people who are at the top of the pile, who have access to the best medical care and pain relief and so forth and so on. Of course, it's vulnerable communities, the physically or cognitively disabled, especially if they are poor, people who are in marginalized groups, despised racial minorities, and that kind of thing. So the principle of the sanctity of human life is just a specification of that principle of the profound inherent and equal dignity of each and every member of the human family.
Following up on the assisted suicide question, in the book, you talk about the fact that whenever we've had kind of widespread class or groups of people have their rights trampled on, taken away, the first thing that happens is they're dehumanized. And
You bet.
the textbook case is the dehumanization of the unborn, clump of cells, etc. Do you think with the march of assisted suicide, we will start to see, or are you already starting to see attempts to dehumanize those groups that you just mentioned that are the most vulnerable to it, you know, especially with the on the heels of the news of the ARC endorsing assisted suicide. Do you think we'll start to see that?
There's no question, and I think we are already seeing it. And it's terrifying. This will divide the world up into superiors and inferiors, to the people whose interests really count and to the people who were better off being without. It's causing a revival of the most loathsome concept in all of modern thought, and that is the concept in German of Lebensunswerten-Leben. Lives unworthy of life. This, of course, was the theory under which Hitler murdered countless Jewish people, disabled people, Slavic people, people in political or religious groups that he didn't like. They were lives unworthy of life. And you know, Ashley, he didn't begin by killing Jews or Slavs or people in political parties he didn't like. Hitler began by killing disabled people. They were the first victims because they were considered useless eaters, lives unworthy of life, a burden on themselves and a burden on society. And he went from there to killing all the other groups that he killed. But here's the really striking thing that people, I think, either somehow don't know or have forgotten about. Hitler didn't invent, nor did the Nazis invent, the concept of Lebensunswerten-Leben, or the idea that you can legitimately do away with people who qualify as lives unworthy of life. It wasn't invented by Hitler and the Nazis. It was invented in the 19-teens, before anybody had ever heard of Hitler. And it was invented by polite, affluent, well-educated, progressive people in the United States and in Europe who thought that eugenics was the way forward for enlightened people, that we should divide the world into better and worse human beings and try to preserve and advance and grow the population of superior human beings and diminish or depress the population of so-called inferior human beings. Hitler didn't invent it. He took it and ran with it, but it was invented by affluent, well-educated, progressive people, the great and the good. People in progressive circles today don't want to remember that, but it's right there in their heritage. Some very notable eugenicists were people like Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, the big abortion chain in the United States. This is part of that history, part of their history, part of the history of the progressive movement. They want to forget that now. They want to leave that behind. They don't want to pretend that it didn't happen, but it did.
Would you also include the people in the Bloomsbury group and John Maynard Keynes, people like this?
Absolutely. It was the great and the good, Betsy. And leading scholars at my Princeton, at Harvard, the heads of the great foundations, it was the power elite, the WASP establishment. And do you know what they said about people who wouldn't go along with it? Like the Catholic Church or other Christians or religious people who wouldn't go along with it? They would dismiss them, Betsy, as religious fanatics, religious nuts, people who wanted to impose their backward, retrograde morality on other people. All the things, all the slanders you hear today against people who want to uphold the principle of the dignity and sanctity of human life, those same slurs, those same defamations were used against the people who stood up to the establishment against eugenics.
It's interesting that you bring up the elite wealthy people because you have a chapter in your book called Markets, Morality, and Civil Society. And can you explain to our listeners how the free market and the family work together when you uphold the dignity of the person? Because a lot of you have a Democratic socialist who just won the primary in New York
Yeah.
City. And how does Adam Smith also fit into all of this?
Well, I want to say three cheers for the family, and I want to say two cheers for the free market. Now, why not three? Two means I'm really cheering, right? Two cheers. That's pretty good, isn't it? Now, why do I give the market at least two cheers? I give it two cheers because it promotes human flourishing, which is really what it's all about. It supplies people with the material things that they want and need. It generates levels of prosperity unknown in human history before the development of modern economies. All that's good, and we should applaud it. You know, cheer number one. It honors people's freedom. Cheer number two. But it's got to be regulated. It's got to be in line with moral principles. Because the market, if it's abstracted from morality, will buy and sell anything. It'll buy and sell slaves. It'll buy and sell transplantable human organs. It'll sell horrible drugs and pornography and every other kind of evil thing. So just two cheers for the market. It's just an instrumentality. It's not something like the family good in itself. It's a means to other ends, but it's an important one. And I would say, along with the institution of marriage, it's one of the two greatest anti-poverty programs ever created. Market economies have lifted millions of people out of poverty. Marxists believe that what they called capitalism, the market economy, would immiserate the masses, immiserate people. It hasn't done that at all, which is why you never got the workers' revolution that Marx thought you would get in industrial societies. Not a one. It's never happened. And that's because it doesn't. The market doesn't immiserate people. It lifts people higher and higher in term in economic terms, but it won't substitute for the spiritual and the moral. And here's where the family comes in. And three cheers for the family. The family is intrinsically and not merely instrumentally valuable. It's not just a means to getting the kids up in the morning and washed and fed and off to school. We flourish precisely by being part of the family. That's one of the fundamental aspects of human flourishing. This is my, the basic thrust of that chapter, that there are certain principles that have to be in place if we're to have decent and dynamic societies. One of those, it's an absolute, any kind of decent society will have a healthy marriage-based family. If you want not only a decent society, but a dynamic society, one in which prosperity can be generated, in which people can rise up, where we got social mobility, then you will also need the market. Now, you can have a decent society that's not dynamic. Amish societies are very decent. They're not dynamic. But if you want a decent and dynamic society, and there's nothing wrong with having a dynamic society, you're going to need the market. But you can't let the market run free of moral constraints and moral considerations. So I'm not defending here a laissez-faire market system. I'm not identifying market outcomes as inherently just. I don't take the view that if the market generates the outcome, then it's just, then it's good. Markets can generate bad outcomes, which is why you need moral constraints. But within those constraints, the market can promote, as the family inherently does, human flourishing.
I don't want to end the interview without touching on universities, because you
Oh, yeah.
yourself are a professor. You've done the unthinkable, which is you've been a tenured chaired professor at Princeton University for how many years?
40 years, just finished my 40th year.
Wow, congratulations. And have, during that time seen just a dramatic unfolding across America's campuses. And you talk about illiberalism and the idea that people can't, students can't even encounter or discuss opposing viewpoints anymore. And even when I was at Tufts, we had a debate between Peter Beinart and Ann Coulter. That would be unthinkable, I think, today in, today's setting. How did we get to this point? And do you have hope for the universities, for America's campuses?
Well, I do have hope, and I'll tell you what the basis of my hope is. It's very straightforward, but it's very powerful. The basis of my hope is that every year, year in and year out, I get to teach brilliant students. I mean, the Princeton admissions office keeps us on the faculty supplied with what seems like an endless supply of absolutely brilliant students. But that's not really what gives me hope. It's not their brilliance. It's that so many of these young men and women, they're maybe not the majority, but nevertheless, a substantial minority that I'm blessed to teach are not only brilliant, they're courageous. They're speaking out against the dominant orthodoxies of the day, what Orwell called the smelly little orthodoxies of the time. They challenge the age of feeling. They challenge identitarian ideologies. They challenge these cultural norms at great risk to themselves. Betsy and I were talking earlier about some of my former students, Tom Hayne, who's a politician now out in Illinois, Sharif Girgis, who's an outstanding scholar, Daniel Mark, another outstanding scholar, Melissa Muscala, Anna Sam. I could go on and on. And these kids just inspire me. They are so brave and so brilliant, and they go out there and they make the case. Now, the question is, how do we get the institutions to stop functioning as catechism classes for particular ideologies and to start doing education again? Education is not indoctrination. Indoctrination is the very antithesis of education. It doesn't matter whether it's indoctrination, by the way, Ashley, of the right or the left. Any indoctrination is the very antithesis of education. I'd rather my students be ignorant than they be indoctrinated. If they're ignorant, then maybe I can teach them something. But if they're indoctrinated, before I'm ever going to be able to teach them something, I'm going to have to pry their minds open with a crowbar, and that's really hard once those minds have been shut because students have gotten themselves into the grip of ideology. And it's up to universities to cut it out with the indoctrination and start doing real teaching. Now, how do they do that? Simple, straightforward. You present the best arguments. You expose your students to the best that has been thought and said on competing sides of all the debated questions in our society, whether they're life and death questions, economic questions, questions about marriage and sexual morality, questions about race and class and culture, even in literature and in the sciences. The way you advance the cause of learning is to teach why people on one side say this and people on the other side say that. That happens much more even in science than people recognize. Science proceeds by people disagreeing and moving it forward in very, very many ways. So it's not hard, but it takes the will to do it. You have to break out of your own ideological cocoon, the leadership of universities, the professoriate, to do that. We need to make sure that there's a broader representation of viewpoints on campus. It's a scandal today that campuses' faculties are entirely ideologically one-sided. That is a scandal. And it's not just that it's unfair to points of view that are excluded. That's bad enough. But much worse is it undermines the very mission of the university, which is the advancement of knowledge.
Well, Professor George, we are so thankful for your time today and commend your new book to our listeners. It really has got to be one of the most comprehensive books that I've seen covering just about every issue or philosophical question that we are struggling with culturally right now. So thank you so much, Professor George, for your time.
A pleasure, Ashley. Thank you, and thank you, Betsy.